has the inherent complexity of society removed maybe the natural checks that we used to have in sociopathic behavior?
I think if we're kind of debating in the corner of whether or not sociopathy is needed in leadership, I would argue against that we do not need it.
If you think about what democracy is, it is a sort of popularity contest, right? Like, you simply, you're not going to get the votes unless people know you. And the people that are most adept at getting popular and manipulating others, well, it turns out those are sociopaths. Welcome to Radius of Reason. I'm Levon with my co-host, Andre. And today we have yet another Meta Crisis episode.
So one of the contributing factors to the meta crisis, or what we call the interconnected problems humanity is facing from a standpoint of technology, politics, economics, the environment, is the prevalence of sociopaths who are running our systems. To discuss this, we're joined today by the author of a great Substack called Soulful Systems. Her name is Trusana, and her work focuses on the connection between human psychology and the meta crisis.
Trusana, what role do sociopaths play in the meta crisis?
So let's talk about the meta crisis first. So meta crisis is a totality of risk that we as a species and the planet is currently facing. And the problems, the issue with the meta crisis is complex and interconnected and systemic in nature, and it cannot be solved by themselves. How does sociopathy play into the meta crisis is this very thing that there has been an increase in mental health disorder across the board. And the problem with, you know, that sociopathy has been in the news so much is because that we are seeing a lot of sociopath in powerful positions. Mm-hmm. And okay, let's just maybe take it back, because that is the clinical term for sociopathy. It's called antisocial personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And just to understand where it's placed, you know, in kind of like, you know, how does it all fit in with how we diagnose mental disorder is, to put it simply, mental disorder practitioners have this thing called the DSM to classify mental disorders. Mm-hmm. And if you were to place in, you know, really kind of three big categories, there's is the mad, the bad, and the sad. So the mad is, you know, we know the mad, you know, it's this schizophrenia. We got the people who's very paranoid. We're kind of thinking, you know, like kind of a Gotham kind of insane asylum. And then there's the mad, which is what we're talking about today. You know, there's antisocial personality disorder. There's narcissistic personality disorder. There's borderline personality disorder. And there's this other thing called histrionic personality disorder. In this group, the mad group, we actually call it cluster B. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if you want to understand it, it's a group of mental disorder of people who suffer from normal emotional regulation. They have problem regulating their emotions. And the last one, it's a sad, which we're not talking about today, but just, you know, quickly touch on it, is just, you know, depressive disorder, OCD. The sad disorder. But how this kind of all plays in is, you know, we're very interested in the mad, you know, the cluster B mental disorder, because we're seeing a lot of this traits being perpetuated in, you know, leadership positions everywhere. And, you know, this is sociopathy is characterized by a perversive pattern of a disregard of, or violation of the rights of others. You know, there's, you know, to list out, there's like deceitfulness, there's manipulation, there's impulsiveness, there's consistent irresponsibility, there's the lack of remorse, lack of empathy. And in order for you to be classified or diagnosed in, you know, the antisocial personality disorder, you have to have a lot of things. You know, I think you have to have three out of the thing I listed just now, and you have to have an onset of it before you turn 15. So as you can see, it's really hard to kind of get people to be diagnosed under this category. But, you know, kind of like a blanket term for sociopathy. I think that's what we're talking about today. Not so much under people who's been clinically diagnosed.
And is it something, just real quick, is it something that is innate to sociopath in terms of their nature, or is it something that is systemically produced? Is it context dependent?
This is a debatable one, because there's been a lot of kind of a public discourse, you know, conversations on this, and a lot of question has come up, like, you know, what's the difference between sociopath and psychopath? And there used to be this definition, you know, the kind of explanation that say sociopath are born and sociopath are made. So that's like kind of a more social or environmental factors that comes into play with sociopath.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the show, make sure to hit subscribe, like, comment, anything else they should do, Andre?
I mean, really just tell us how we're doing. We always love seeing your beautiful, beautiful comments. And they're kind of capturing of some of our economic and political systems, because that's kind of what we're talking about both, right? We're not limiting it to talking about these roles in business versus government. We're taking it holistically. But do you feel that this is something about maybe a predominant global culture emerging that makes it viable for these sorts of disorders to seize power and to exploit power? Or is it something a little bit more nefarious and insidious, where just in human systems in general, we're vulnerable to these kinds of personality traits taking charge and taking control?
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, it's multifaceted, right? So there's the element of it being our culture perpetuate this as well. You know, I think kind of like down the line, we're going to be talking about the culture that foster this kind of personality traits. Whether it's a disorder or not, I think that comes into the spectrum of things. You know, if you're scoring quite high on the spectrum, then that becomes a disorder. Mm-hmm. When it kind of compromises the way that you are living, you know, the way that you are connecting with other people, the way you are tackling the problems, how you see the problems at hand. Because part of the problem with sociopathic behaviors or characteristics is that they lack the long-term vision to solve problems. Everything is very short-term, very too much of their personal gain, as opposed to a collective impact.
And, you know, looking at some of the stats, so around 4% of the general population seems like it could be classified with antisocial personality disorder. Let's just call it sociopathy for simplicity. And it seems to be 3 times more common in men than women, which kind of, I guess, confirms that confirms the feminist view that the patriarchy is the problem. But there's also, I think, 20% of CEOs are potentially sociopaths. And I think I read another stat where the state of Washington, D.C., or the District of Washington, D.C., or Jesus Christ, what am I saying? The District of Columbia, where all the... all the politicians in the U.S. has the highest like rate of sociopathy. So I'm probably coincidence. Yeah, well, it's just a coincidence, I'm sure. So I guess, given this prevalence of sociopathy in our society and in particular positions of power, is there a utility to sociopathy, and what are kind of the evolutionary origins behind it? Because surely it exists for a reason, and especially from a game theoretic standpoint, it has some sort of advantage.
If you look at the benefits of this characteristics, that they like to take risks and they can handle immense amount of stress as something of a benefit, then yes, but it's still very short term, you see, because even though it exists within the evolutionary biology explanation that, you know, our ancestors are anxious people, you know, the reason that we have survived, you know, through the ages is because of this anxiety trait, you know, for us to be, you know, kind of like always looking out for the negative. That has been, you know, so advantageous to our survival. But our culture right now, we're talking about modern society right now, we're talking about capitalism or, you know, neoliberalism, that has exacerbated these, you know, these kind of a more negative traits in ourselves. So in a way that there is a biological advantage to have these traits, but in excess, you know, in extreme cases, and this is where is it in extreme cases now, because it's completely like fostered and exacerbated. We are in the moment of crisis that it has gone completely unchecked. That's the problem right now.
Is it inevitable though, given like the scale of societies, as societies become larger and we've moved from hunter-gatherer tribes to just, you know, chiefdoms and then nation states and so on, and this now this more or less global society, is it an inevitable byproduct in the sense that there is greater anonymity between individuals, which means there's a total lack of transparency and thus a lack of accountability for people's actions. So the rewards of sociopathic behavior are greater and the costs are, you know, minimal compared to the past. So like just as a natural byproduct of the scaling up, it seems like unless you were to somehow make society more transparent, it's just like how it's just a better kind of strategy, I guess, for
has the inherent complexity of society removed maybe the natural checks that we used to have in sociopathic behavior.
I think if we're kind of debating in the corner of whether or not sociopathy is needed in leadership, I would argue against that we do not need it.
Fascinating.
Because I feel that sociopathy is actually a maladaptive form of the traits that we're supposed to have. So if you were to kind of dissect sociopathy, right? So if we can go straight to the concept of the dark triad. And the dark triad is a concept that's actually been recently coined. It's like post-millennium, you know, like post-year 2000. Mm-hmm. So it's really new. And psychology itself is very new as well. You know, it's only like kind of like 100 years ago that we started kind of framing what, you know, the study of the mind. Mm-hmm. So dark triad is consists of three dark traits. So there's narcissism, there's Machiavellianism, and there's psychopathy. So if you were to look at these three, you know, dark traits, on average, these three traits, we kind of all need it. You know, we kind of score on average because it works on a spectrum, right? So narcissism, if you were to be of healthy level, you would have a good self, you know, good level of self-esteem. You would have a good level of drive and ambition, for example. Machiavellianism, for example, if you were to have a good level of it, you would have good level of influencing skills, you know, to make things happen. But if you're kind of like, you know, negatively on a negative spectrum, then you're using it to manipulate people. Or, you know, psychopathy, for example, you can look at it in a more beneficial sense as well, that, you know, you become less stressed under a very stressful situation. So, you know, these kind of like dark traits do have the benefits that associated with it in the right balance. But sociopathy is all of these in a very, very kind of extreme spectrum. These are people who has a disorder. You know, they're maladapting to their environment. They have a gap, you know, usually they have a gap of understanding of what reality is. They have one version of their mind as opposed to, you know, the reality that everyone else actually experiencing. Mm-hmm. They have trouble regulating their emotions. And they have that the lack of skill to empathize with others as well. So in a sense, social media is not good for leadership at all. You know, that there are so many other traits that is needed in leadership. And then sociopathy would probably be, you know, ranking quite low.
So how would you then kind of look at the historical examples of individuals that maybe manifested some of these traits of a dark triad that we look at as kind of great forces of movement in history? So for instance, Napoleon, you know, there's obviously a very complex legacy there, but we can agree hopefully that he introduced, let's say, the foundations of a model legal system to France, for instance. Napoleon, by all accounts, definitely manifested various forms of the dark triad in his ruthlessness and his vanity, but weren't those things necessary to drive the outcomes that he was seeking?
I think it's debatable. I think I've heard a lot of this, you know, these types of arguments that, you know, you do need to be like someone like Steve Jobs, for example, you know, right, to kind of drive for that innovation. I think there are benefits to it for sure.
Right.
But I think more the point that we're kind of focusing is, what about the darker aspects that go unnoticed?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like the main point. I think, you know, the things that comes with the drive, the ambition, the innovation, you know, fight for the things that's kind of like beyond one person can do, you know, that kind of drive that is like so inhuman, but they went for it anyway. Mm-hmm. I respect that. And I do see the benefits of that, but I do see the other, you know, the kind of like the other hidden forms that essentially becomes the very thing that we're facing right now in terms of like the long-term impact that.
So it would be fair to say that your position is that because we've had these trends of sociopaths leading our political and economic movements, that has brought us to the place today where we're sitting here discussing the meta crisis, that all these things kind of were a daisy chain that resulted in this complex web of problems that humanity is facing.
I think so. It's very interconnected. And I think it is, it does set the scene, you know, the stage back then for it. And this is kind of like, we are living in the remnant of that model, you know, of us thinking that actually maybe leaders do need that kind of drive, you know, that kind of the thing that average man don't possess, for example.
Well, I mean, I would say not only like is it us thinking this way, I think we're pretty much obsessed with those traits. I think any like 21st century guide to leadership in any form is always going to be glorifying these sorts of like elements of the dark triad that you described. And I think that is something I'll agree with you with, that it's something where almost to a toxic level obsessed with. I mean, open up your LinkedIn page and just see what insanity is being posted on there. It's all kind of a result of this glorification of these sorts of toxic traits to a certain extent.
Absolutely.
Yvonne, you were going to say something.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, I think the main issue here is not simply that the sociopathic traits may lend themselves in certain ways, you know, being more cold and calculated. You know, you're thinking like corporate environments, you know, they can fire people with ease and they can make more risky decisions without caring about the impact on their employees or whatever. Or in the case of Genghis Khan, they can go around killing and raping untold numbers of people. I think the problem here is they can outcompete other forms of leadership, right, that could also produce great results. They could also help create more arguably far more sustainable societies, right? Societies that are not as prone to meta-crisis-esque issues. But you are not looking at these things in a vacuum, right? So long as sociopaths exist, and so long as really that game theory reward exists for sociopathic behavior, even if you had a society where you didn't have any sociopath, let's say you did something horrible and you just, well, yeah, I mean, it would be horrible to kill all sociopaths, right?
So it's like a sociopathic thing.
You still have an evolutionary attraction towards that behavior through, you know, genetic drift and mutations and whatnot. Ultimately, you know, you have that room for exploitation, which would eventually be filled, right? That's a niche that would be filled over time. And so, so long as you have that incentive, and in our case, not only do you have that incentive, but you actually have people that are genetically very much predisposed to those tendencies, then it is the competition between sociopaths and non-sociopaths. And that's where it gets interesting, because the sociopaths, because of their ability to focus on the short-term gain and perhaps lack the empathy for that long-term kind of consequence, will outcompete the non-sociopaths. And I think how do you get over that hurdle is what I'm most interested in, you know, in.
Wow, it's a hard question. It kind of takes, we need two solutions for this, because we're talking about, you know, the individual level of, you know, are we fostering these kind of behaviors? Are we calling out these behaviors? Are we part of the problem that enabling this culture to go and call out for example? And then that's like, you know, the overarching systems that obviously value and rewarding these types of behavioral traits already, you know, both things need to happen. I feel, you know, we're already kind of talking about, you know, the capitalistic nature of our society and it having kind of like messed up our orientation of our values. You know, we completely like lost our ways, basically. You know, mm-hmm. what it means to be good, what it means to be bad. Because I think in our previous session, you know, when we first talked about sociopathy, you kind of like, you asked me about the personality test, whether should we just give out the test to people, you know, and then they can just, you know, rate themselves. The test would rate them as to whether they score high on the sociopathic tendencies. And I think that's a really good idea. But I feel that even with the test right now, I think we can tell who are the sociopath in our lives, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
They are quite
obvious.
That's
a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
But we're not doing anything about it. Yeah. So the problem is not in the identification of sociopath in our society. It's actually, what do we do when we see them? Like, how do we call them out? Like, what do we do? You know, we get whistleblowers in, you know, coming out, and then they are actually, in fact, become the victim themselves. And, you know,
in the case of Boeing. Yeah, definitely.
Oh my God! Right, the Boeing engineer.
Mm. They've already whacked two of them, allegedly.
My God. And we're seeing this all the time, you know, everywhere, globally, you know, of the bad guys winning again, and we can obviously see who the bad guys are. But then, you know, the tools or like the kind of the things that we need to do to sort this out is that's the problem.
So I mean, but wouldn't creating a system in which we like limit a pool of individuals' access to power or to participation in any form of like social function, let's say, like if we're talking about a model where we start deploying sociopath tests to identify the sociopaths and then like not letting them run for office, isn't that inherently an undemocratic principle? And would we not be then building a system that is sociopathic in its own right and just perpetuating the wheel? And maybe as a caveat to that, do you feel then that inclusive systems are going to be further contributing to the meta crisis? As in, if we are continuing to allow sociopaths to participate, then we're not going to be able to address some of these compounding issues we're facing as humanity.
I think, you know, giving out tests to identify people who has sociopathic tendencies and then not letting them in would be considered discrimination. In a way.
Yes. Yes. Very much so.
Because in a way they are classified as a mental disorder. Well, and I'm sure there are various laws protecting.
Isn't there also an issue in terms of, because it is a disorder, but on a spectrum, you know, like where now, like where are you drawing that line? Right. Like who is now classified as a sociopath and because there is probably, you know, some subjectivity involved in that analysis and that judgment, then that leaves the door open for, you know, some sort of corruption or abuse of that, using that kind of as a determinant.
Yeah. So I was kind of thinking, I've been pondering about this a lot because now that you mentioned the test, and I've just been thinking about it all week, I thought that maybe what we can do is just kind of like shift the focus a little bit instead of, you know, creating a test that we can identify who are the sociopath. Why not create a test that we can identify who are, you know, the kind of characters that we want in leadership, you know, things, the things that we value, like, you know, empathy, integrity, responsibility, accountability. These should be, you know, in the test. These should be the thing that we, you know, we put more value into finding.
Is there a way to craft such a test that isn't, you know,
someone's working on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So this is kind of like a continuous work from the Dark Triad. And this guy, I can't remember his name exactly, maybe Daniel Kahneman. So he worked on this other thing called the Light Triad. Yeah, so cool. It's a bit of a light and dark force. Yeah, very Star Wars. And yeah, but he's obviously working on this test.
But I want to go back to something that Andre mentioned earlier, and it has to do with the inclusivity and exclusivity principle when it comes to sociopaths in these prominent positions or political positions. Let's see. Is there something inherent to democracy that lends itself toward, you know, sociopaths being victorious politically in such a kind of setup? Because if you think about what democracy is, it is a sort of popularity contest, right? Like, you're not going to get the votes unless people know you. And the people that are most adept at getting popular and manipulating others, well, it turns out those are sociopaths. So there is a sort of tension between sociopathy and democracy, right? Or let's rather sociopathy and good governance, because in terms of electing people based on a democratic model. So is there another kind of system or procedure for electing decision makers that wouldn't be as predisposed to that issue?
I think you mentioned something before in the email, about, right? The one that
I may have. Yeah. So thank you for setting me up. So yes, the other possibility is what we had discussed in a prior episode. We came up with this kind of new system for international coordination just as a thought experiment. But one of the core ideas was to use a draft mechanism to obtain who will be the decision makers for a set of issues.
A set period of time, right?
For a set period of time. And you would also have this, you know, idea of recursion and continuously cycle through these people, because you would assume that over time they would be corrupted as well by different interest groups. That's another story. But if you were to draft people into positions of power, you are now, because it would be, again, more or less random, you are bypassing that entire procedure of, okay, people will focus on the most sociopathic, popular, manipulative, charismatic individuals. And so you're kind of just bypassing that whole thing, more or less. I'm speaking in circles, but I guess that's one way to counter the issue of politicians being kind of predisposed in that direction inherent to the political process. But ultimately, I'm curious what you guys think about this. We can do X, Y, or Z, but the wider system, the wider society, you know, especially when you look at our economic model, it is more or less still incentivizing sociopathic values in people. Like you still, in corporations, in even everyday life, because of just the degree of anonymity, and what our values are in general, like we're incentivizing this thing. And so is there a way, I mean, would we have to craft just a different value structure altogether, which means a different sort of economic principle or guiding principle? Like, is this just like too monumental of a task without a massive shift in the values?
Yes. I mean, if it's talking about systemic level, definitely monumental. What I would propose as a more practical solution to this is really on an individual basis. So when you mention about, you know, a democratic process, or how, you know, people would obviously vote for the most charismatic politician, that's the problem in itself, right? I mean, sociopaths are already quite easy to spot if you look at them on a kind of long-term span of time. You can tell, you know, they lack integrity. That's the number one thing. So if we were to inject the information literacy to the public more, so to have the public awareness of certain traits like this, I think that's the way forward, you know, kind of like increasing the collective consciousness of what is the problem right now, what they should be looking out for in leaders. I think it needs to start at individual level to have that awareness first.
Okay, what specifically like would be ways to catalyze that individual change?
There are a lot. I mean, the fact that we're having this podcast right now, right? You know, the public discourse, or like the information being pumped into the kind of like the social media sphere right now about, you know, leadership, narcissism, sociopathy, democracy, you know, capitalism, you know, like we are in kind of like we're actually this year, 2024, we're post-pandemic as well. You know, a lot of things has shifted. I think the critical thinking, I feel the critical thinkers movement is coming. I'm not sure that you've been feeling the same, but I have felt this wave of you know, kind of like the new kind of thinking, the new knowledge about, you know, to spot the kind of the not so good social behaviors.
We're seeing this in terms of how people are relating to their employers. I think like as Gen Z steps into a working life, they're putting up with less and less bullshit from the workplace. They're again exploring the potential for unionizing. There is this sort of movement to kind of calling out the more destructive forces in the workplace, which I think is where we see it manifesting most often. But I'm curious, how do you view, you describe the fact that people are having more conversations online about emotional abuse, about mental health, and all these things are fantastic. And I love that in some of the pieces you've written on your Substack, or in one of them, you cited Dr. Ramani, who's kind of this like really, really popular internet personality who was also a PhD in psychology. And she has a lot of material that she writes about regarding what to do, you know, when you encounter a narcissist or sociopath. But do you consider that this could also be damaging? Is that if we put everything through this sort of prism, that everything that is maybe a natural spectrum of human behavior, because we all have elements of the dark triangle or the dark triad, excuse me, in our day-to-day, right? I mean, we exhibit it, I believe, depending on various factors, how much sleep you're getting, how much food you're getting, you know, these various qualities that might make you behave in a certain way that's not optimal. But to ultimately have a broad brush that everything is painted with And all of a sudden, what is just a regular spectrum of quote unquote normal human behavior is painted as, oh my God, it's a narcissist. And you are seeing kind of, I guess if this is a backlash, it's the backlash to the backlash where people are saying, oh wait, no, all of this heightened awareness of internet pop psychology, quote unquote, is actually damaging because it's oversimplifying very complex disorders and it's causing people to look for things in their relationships that might not necessarily be there. So, I mean, do you feel that maybe this hyper awareness of these sorts of disorders and mental illnesses, it's actually doing more damage to us in the long run?
Really good point. I mean, absolutely. I think the risk of demonizing, a disorder is really real, and we're seeing it. A great example, Dr. Romani. I mean, I've seen her. I've watched loads of her videos before, and I've seen online conversation attacking her, saying that she is creating a backlash to people who are experiencing these types of disorders. But I think you have to remember that the audience that Dr. Romani is speaking to are the survivors, the people who are looking to get out of a toxic relationship. So I think we have to kind of be kind of mindful of, who her audience is. And there are loads of conversations about sociopath. I think I saw an article in the New York Times back earlier this year of a woman. I think her name was Patrick Garnier. Mm-hmm. And she literally just came out as a self-proclaimed sociopath. And then she wrote a book. Yeah. And she wrote a book on it. And, I read a few articles about her, and it's so interesting, to hear it from the perspective of a really highly functional sociopath who comes out to really kind of detail her life and how she navigate, all these complexities in her life of her not having, similar sets of normal reaction, emotions to other people. So, she does, come to say that she does lack remorse. Sometimes she would go in to steal things in the store, and then it would just be, her spurt of this desire that she wants to do, and she'll just go and steal something. So, we do have kind of self-proclaimed, self-confessed sociopath making immediate headlines in the New York Times, and then coming out with this book, and it's a New York Times bestseller now. And we're obviously learning more from different angles, and I think that's the way forward, isn't it? To hear it from different perspectives. The people who actually suffer from sociopath, the people who are actually sociopath, or the people who are, say the children of sociopathic parents, for example. Mm. And there are loads of kind of different angles to the story. And I just think the public just needs to absorb, all these kind of different perspectives to how we are viewing these types of mental disorders that has huge impact to our society right now. Because if we were to ask anyone right now to say that, do you know anyone who would kind of display these kind of traits? I bet you 99% of, the listeners to your podcast would say, actually, I do know someone. I do know someone. It's that person.
But, I think it's interesting because when you look at it in terms of politics, if someone's on your tribe, all of a sudden now you're blind.
Yeah. Yeah. You're willing to excuse and forgive all this kind of behavior.
Like, is Donald Trump, for example, if you were to ask people on the left, 100% would agree that he's a sociopath, but what percentage on the right would, right? It would be a significantly lower number. So, I mean, there's so many different biases. That's why I really like your point about how we can kind of identify sociopaths, even if we don't admit it, on a survey about, or even to our friends, oh, do you think Trump is a sociopath? It's like, oh, no, whatever. But it's like deep down inside, I think people do have that intuition. It's just there are other incentives and other variables clouding.
It's tribalism. Yeah. And sometimes we do see sociopathic leaderships in corporations, and we don't do anything about it. Why? Because it's our employment. The power is up there, and then what can we do?
Well, what's interesting is, sorry to interrupt, but I want to make sure I don't forget this. So I read an article recently where sociopaths in positions of power in corporations, they would hire more sociopaths. Mm-hmm. So there is a sort of compounding effect.
Of course. They would surround themselves with yes men. Mm. So of course, you know, they wouldn't hire someone who is going to be opposing to their views. And then, and yeah, of course.
But I mean, I think, and this is where my like opposition to any sort of like testing or identifying system comes into play, because I think this really isn't about the individuals. It's not about, you know, a sociopath running company X, Y, and Z. To me, it's 100% a reflection of this stage of like maybe global economic system that we've developed that kind of came into the fold in the 1990s, right? This neoliberal capitalist model. I think it just, this is the sort of individual that's going to float to the top of it. And if not, the system is just going to grind you down. And it, to be successful and to be, maybe to even survive in this system, you do have to have these sorts of ruthless characteristics that Trisani described in The Dark Triad, because otherwise you're not going to float to the surface. And to the point, Levon, you were making, it is kind of a social arms race to a certain extent, where the ones that manifest these qualities, maybe that aren't aware of them or are aware of them and they still behave in the way they do, they're always going to rise to the top because the system in itself enables it, because we don't have an alternative. And I mean, this is, I think, quite a fascinating conversation that we're having, because Trisani, you're not based in the United States. We're based in the United States, and yet we're discussing things that we can kind of all, to a certain extent, agree on, and we're all seeing this within our own respective societies, right? So I think that we can run as many tests as we want. We can, you know, create as many institutions as we want to prevent or try to prevent sociopaths from seizing any form of formal control. But as long as we have our current socioeconomic system in place without any reforms, then we're just going to have this sort of problem over and over again. And then we're going to have a system in which the sociopaths are administering sociopathic tests to prevent other sociopaths from getting the power. And I think it's maybe a, again, if we talk about the meta crisis as like a self-perpetuating entity and a cyclical pattern, this is it, right? It is the system which was built perhaps by sociopaths and enabled by sociopaths is continuously functioning, producing more and more of these sorts of individuals, because nobody's writing. I mean, you talked about Steve Jobs. We have, I mean, it's probably fair to say on a global scale, a cult of Steve Jobs. Everybody sees him as this like grand innovator, this grand sort of visionary. And nobody talks about, like, I don't know, the one pleasant individual at Apple that wasn't going to be like ruthless. It's a systemic thing, I think, not an individual thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, if we were to take ourselves back to, you know, the late 20th century, you know, mm-hmm. going back to the neoliberalism movement, it started from there. That's the value of neoliberalism movement. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, that was solving the problem of, you know, economic stagnation. You know, it was kind of like a post-World War II kind of situation. We needed mm-hmm. to inject more into the economy. So it was, you know, kind of like the prominent figures back then was like, you know, US was Reagan, in the UK was Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, and, yes.
Right. So it was, kind of the movement into like, you know, we need to kind of, go, you know, privatization. We wanted like, the state to have less, control of the economy, more private sector to go in and expand. And it was all of that, you know, those values, you know, growth, you know, profits over the collective, you know, on the environment, profits over the everything else. And that essentially are the values that has completely, you know, took us to the meta crisis conversation today.
Fascinating. And you write a lot on your Substack about the role of trauma in a lot of this. Mm. Do you feel that the current neoliberal system, if you will, it's kind of mass deploying trauma globally? It's only further contributing to the rise of these sorts of personality traits, or is trauma maybe innate just to humans in general? And if we were living in like a, I don't know, like a communist utopia, we would have the same exact situation going on.
I think trauma is very natural in human nature. But repressed trauma, as in like ongoing untreated trauma, that's the problem. That really is the problem. And
untreated trauma is the problem.
Untreated.
So yeah. Trauma, so like, is always going to, yeah, go ahead.
So we talk about kind of like trauma as something like something that it's not something that happens to you. It's something that happens to you. Sorry, it's not something that happens to you, but it's something that happened inside you because of what happens to you. So it's essentially like how you took it inside, how you process it or not process it.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're not really manifesting a quote unquote global culture that is able to effectively address that, which again, to your earlier point, maybe we're moving in the opposite direction now, like with the changes happening after the COVID-19 pandemic, it seems we're talking about these things more, but on like a massive scale, we don't really have the institutions in place to kind of effectively address this and effectively treat it or even understand it maybe on like a medicinal scale to an extent that we're just going to produce more and more of these kind of dark triad personality traits, which will continue to feed into the system because the system we've constructed is enabling these sorts of behaviors. Therefore, here we have it, the unaddressed path we're heading on for the meta crisis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we're coming towards the end now of the era of toxic positivity. I think, have you heard of Mark Manson?
Mark Manson, is he the pickup artist guy?
No, he's the guy who wrote the subtle art of not giving a fuck.
Yeah. That's another Manson.
That one. We have to beat that. Yeah. So he is heavily critical of the toxic positivity culture.
Okay.
We're like the 90s kid, right? We grew up with like, you know, Disney movies, and we grew up with like, you know, heroes and marvels and you know, things are like kind of always good, you know, like the white picket fence, you know, like good life, you know, our social media is kind of like all created, everything looks so perfect. Oh no, shush, don't talk about negative feelings. You know, we've been in that era of, you know, suppress it, you know, you shouldn't, you know, men don't cry, boys don't cry, shush, you know, you shouldn't be feeling sad, you know, you should be happy all the time. And essentially, you know, the problem is happiness is not a constant state. Happiness is not something you should be, you know, it's not a permanent retainment. It's literally fleeting, right? But we've kind of not been taught that. We've kind of like been taught to chase after happiness.
Again, like this is fascinating to me because I agree with you 100%. Why do you think it's such a pervasive, this culture of toxic positivity? Why is it a global thing, right? I mean, 100 years ago, you know, you have like maybe a cult, like, I don't know if they're stereotypes or maybe we can call them cultural peculiarities that would predisposition you to viewing trauma and stress in different ways, right? You can talk about like, I guess in the Western cultural experience, the rift between like Catholicism and Protestantism in terms of how Protestants see punishment and trial and turmoil as one thing, as like, yes, this is the way to legitimize kind of your place in the eyes of God, is that you persevere through these things and you work hard and you develop these things. And Catholics might have a different approach to it. And there is historically a very visible cultural difference between, let's say, Northern and Southern Europe, right? Where there were peculiarities associated with how they engage with their experiences with life on a day-to-day basis. And I'm sure there's just as of a complex relationship with those sorts of things in Eastern cultures as well. But it seems now we're almost reaching like a universal thing where everybody's kind of playing along with the toxic positivity stuff. What's going on? Why have we lost that cultural relativism and how we interpret life and how we move through life?
I think social media played a huge part in this, right? We used to kind of like get news from people just when we're meeting face to face. But now we're literally like seeing stories of people But it's curated, you know, these all positive story, and it's constant. It's all day long. You can be scrolling, you know, all day long. And I think it's exacerbated the feeling of, you know, kind of like one upmanship with one another. And there's this kind of like heightened competition within ourselves, you know, it's not just from a social perspective, with it, our innate drive to compete with other people is very heightened as well.
Let me ask you something. Do you think the invention of photography and obviously the proliferation of smartphones and the ability to take selfies and maybe, you know, all the way back, it started with a mirror. But like, do you think that has exacerbated narcissism? I mean, it's just
for sure. Right. It's almost like a playground for narcissists. Because you're getting that all the time. You're getting this dopamine hit, you know, of like, oh, you know, I'm consuming this. You're kind of getting this short term spurt of like happiness from consuming social media.
Yeah. There's nothing more beautiful. You know, they say there's that quote, you know, nothing sounds more beautiful than like the sound of your own name. And nothing looks more beautiful than perhaps your face. You know, on Instagram with some degree of likes, yeah. I guess.
but I do want to go back to the point about trauma, though, because I think that's the birthing place, I would say, for all the disorders in our life. Trauma in childhood experience. That's where it starts.
You've referenced, I'd say, the controversial book, The Body Keeps the Score.
Yes.
In your work multiple times, yeah.
Why is it controversial?
There are schools of thought that it's oversimplifying the nature of trauma. And that
it's pseudoscience.
Some people say it is. Some people say it isn't. As with many things, I think it's taken as gospel by some circles. It's completely rejected by others. It likely falls somewhere in between. Is what I imagine.
It's a very, very new idea, I would say. I've not heard a lot of people who've come out to talk in depth about how trauma has manifested in people, you know, at which stage of life that has impacted the people. But I think there's two names, you know. There's this guy who wrote The Body Keeps a Score, Bessel van Kolk, and Gabor Mate, who does trauma work.
That's right.
Yeah. So I think really, you know, like if we go back to you know, sociopathy and everything else, I just said, you know, about the kind of the bad cluster, you know, the cluster B, they have issues with emotional regulation. Mm-hmm. And this can actually dates back to when you're a kid, you know, when your upbringing, you know, it's usually kind of like forms because you've been neglected when you were young. So you're constantly needing this, you know, attention and love from your primary caregiver that you don't get. Then you kind of grow up, you know, kind of like had your feelings invalidated. And this is kind of like, you know, all the trauma is stored inside your body. And then it kind of like manifests in later life that you don't really understand why you have this kind of tendencies.
So it all kind of traces back to capitalism in terms of like, you know, women, I guess also maybe the women's liberation movement in terms of now they can work. And so they're, you know, you're putting kids in daycare and they're not getting that emotional regulation from their primary caregivers. Right. So, I mean, it's all kind of related in a sense, isn't it? Like
I think it's more so like less about parents putting you in daycare, more so about parents not providing you with that care at any point or attention at any point, or even worse, I think it's there's a great quote, Chusana, that you pulled from that book, and I was trying to find it in my notes. It's this concept that trauma is the unexamined life of our parents that we ourselves end up living, I think is the call out you had. And I think that Levon, to your point, Gabor Mate, he squarely places the blame on our current economic system for heightening these sorts of traumas that children experience, which then, in theory, would manifest more and more cluster B personality disorders.
Well, I mean, if you talk about the unexamined life of your parents, I mean, why is it unexamined? You know, how could it be examined when, you know, you're working two jobs or, you know, I mean, it's just the way that we've constructed societies is obviously not conducive to.
But, and again, I think this is where, yeah, we've been talking a lot about like the neoliberal capitalist model, but at the same time, I mean, let's say the Soviet Union, which is probably our greatest form of like an alternative economic system we can reference, even though, you know, probably wasn't that different, largely speaking, but the concept of trauma there was completely non-existent, right? And I think that that's why you have like such a prevalence of mental health issues in the post-Soviet states is because you have a country and a civilization that went through probably some of the most traumatic spheres of human experience in the 20th century with the, you know, the revolution, all of the repressions that happened after the revolution, World War II, millions upon millions of people dying over a span of 50 years, and then nobody ever talked about it.
I mean, right? I'm not sure that's a fair comparison, to be honest, because it's not clear that the economic system in the Soviet Union was the relevant factor. I mean, it could just be that the field of psychology and our concepts of trauma and whatnot were just not developed.
Sure, well, that's enough. Fair. They weren't so developable enough, and that's why I think maybe this isn't exclusively like at the blame of capitalism that we have all these traumatized people walking. I think it's more complex than just like economic models. I think we don't fully understand what produces these sorts of personality disorders, and we're just starting to a certain extent. But I think what we're trying to get at here is that it's kind of a cyclical thing, is that our system, our culture, maybe our global monoculture is producing personality types that will continue to perpetuate that cycle, right? It's a self-perpetuating mechanism, I think, is how
I mean, it goes back to the values, right? So the values in our societies and our structures are the things that we incentivize for. So if the value is more or less to make as much money as possible, that is divorced from the depth of human experience that's required to produce non-sociopathic individuals, right? Or to incentivize the production of non-sociopathic individuals. So it always circles back to the values that are propagated in society. And, and, you know, again, to go back to what you had suggested, which was a sort of grassroots movement of change at the individual level. But I also think, like you do, you always have to couple that with the system. And it has to be something that works in parallel. Because...
But if you're talking about the impact at the system level, that would mean that then all of us would have it, right? We would all kind of like exhibit some kind of sociopathic tendencies.
I think we do to some degree, but
hence we're on a podcast. Yeah.
No, but I think it's more about, you know, it's skewing the likelihood of sociopathic behavior and perhaps the disorder. But, you know, I still think there's some genetic basis for this, but there's the environmental, you know, context and the conditioning that occurs that's just skewed in the wrong direction.
But wouldn't you say that the impact on the kind of the family unit level would be a lot more kind of, you know, kind of feed into the explanation of how these manifest in individual rather than the system itself as well? I mean, we talked a lot about the system, but then essentially like the trauma topic is actually quite fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I think that plays a role too. I mean, I don't think we have to, I guess, pick one or the other. I would say, you know, it's just a combination of those various factors. Does that answer your question? I'm not trying to evade it, but.
Yep. That answers this. Yeah.
I think there's multiple things happening. There's multiple feedback loops, things happening simultaneously. I mean, it's just. It's very difficult. And I mean, Andre, you're right. Like, it's not just capitalism. I mean, I think there are aspects to this that are simply fundamental to the scaling up of societies.
Yeah.
And it's just hard to get away from that. I mean, we live in such a different environment from what our ancestors lived in, from our evolutionary environment, which, you know, is kind of how we're designed, and just simply, and not enough time has elapsed for any sort of biological change to have taken place to adapt to our scale of societies and our new kind of life. But it's a tough one. It's a tough one, but
we've been talking a lot in previous episodes, as Levon mentioned, about creating a international system of coordination of sorts to address the meta crisis, to start at least trying to tackle some of these varying interlinking problems we're facing from a standpoint of technology, warfare, climate, some of the things you've called out on your own page as you've analyzed the meta crisis, Trusana. And one of the things that we want to do is not necessarily recreate the wheel, right? We do have international organizations today. We've had international systems of coordination probably throughout all of like the modern nation state history. But one of the problems that I think it has faced is the fact that these systems do tend to be exploited by these sorts of individuals and personality types that, again, as we discussed at the start of this episode, tend to render them ineffective and kind of contributes more to these compounding crises we're facing. So if you were designing a system, Trusana, of this sort, like a system or an organization to tackle the meta crisis, how would you keep these sorts of personality traits at the minimal influence? Maybe not necessarily at bay, but countering the influence they would have. And we've talked about the test, right? And I think our listeners would probably agree that that's probably not the most effective approach and would probably lead to problems of its own. But how could you design a system that could effectively function at the international scale without the influence or role of a dark triad type? I guess I just asked you like the one question that would make $1 million for everybody.
It is hard from a systemic, you know, to kind of put something in place when we're already kind of discussed that the issues actually are the values. Within the, you know, social, you know, the way economic system has been designed, you know, what value is, you know, if, for example, like if you were to say that if companies, you know, if all corporations don't have to answer to the board and make profits, if it's like, you know, profit, if it's a profit led, we will still be stuck in the same value. I feel that I don't have an answer for tackling it at the systemic value, you know, at the system level. But I am a huge proponent of tackling it at the individual level. And that's kind of like been, you know, the message I've been pushing, that it's hard to kind of design something when in fact the problem itself is the value system of it. So it really kind of had to kind of like, you know, take a step back and then really kind of looking on the individual basis of like, why are we should be asking why, like, why are we not calling out the sociopathic leaders within our own community? And, you know, there's so many reasons as to why we're not doing it. You know, that's this thing called a bystander effect, for example, you know, when we feel kind of pressured to not say anything because of the, you know, the social conformity. Or, you know, there's this kind of like diffusion of responsibility when you're part of a group dynamic and you don't call out the behaviors that, say, if you were to be on one-on-one, you might call it out. So that's, you know, loads of kind of like,
So, and I guess here is the follow-up question that I was trying to work to. So thank you for setting me up again. You're like the ultimate basketball champion here. The concept of enablement, because I think... some of the traits that we've discussed on this episode, that's only one half the problem. The other half is enablement. And there's always an enablement is always, it allows a lot of these exploitations to happen. So could you dive in a little bit into like the traits of enablement and the role of enablement in these sorts of dynamics. And I love that you did kind of point out that it's not necessarily like a systemic thing. It is an individual thing, because everybody makes a conscious choice to a certain extent, right? Everybody makes a choice not to rock the boat, so to speak, to maintain stability, even if they know, again, as you said earlier, everybody knows when they're in the presence of this kind of personality. Everybody knows when somebody's behaving in a way that's maybe a little bit wrong, but in a way you make a conscious choice to allow it to happen. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I am seeing a trend in the normalization of unethical behaviors that are more kind of like higher tolerance to bad behaviors in our society nowadays. You know, there used to be like, we used to never see street fighting, you know, in my days. And then suddenly, like, you know, these days we are seeing people kind of like fighting and then filming. You know, I'm not sure if you've seen Black Mirror before, but then we're actually living in that dystopian version of Black Mirror now. That is a problem. And I think there's a lot of kind of factors that play into this, this kind of like, situation that we're in, is, you know, kind of the social system, the economic system, you know, the social media that, perpetuates this kind of like, you know, you're getting likes for it. You're getting kind of recognition for producing, this type of content. It's kind of like it all feeds in, and, you know, enabling behavior doesn't necessarily mean that you are doing something. Even the inaction of not doing anything, that's enabling.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the things that you don't call out, that becomes your standard. You know, the standard of acceptance. And then we are seeing this, you know, because, you know, we're in a group, that's a diffusion of responsibility. We feel less, you know, less responsible to call something out. And then, you know, it builds in, you know, into your kind of like your own personal identity of it.
So I want to look at this actually from a little bit of a different angle. Is it possible that people don't want to call it out because they like the benefits? Like, for example, a sociopathic leader at a corporation or a sociopathic political leader, perhaps Donald Trump. Is it possible that due to the competitive advantage that these sociopaths offer and perhaps the direct benefit that they can provide to their, you know, constituents or whatever people in the company, is it maybe just like, hey, yeah, I don't maybe love their personality. Maybe I acknowledge, like, you know, they're not like an ideal person. You know, I wouldn't want my daughter to date them type of thing, but they get the job.
But I'm benefiting from this person.
Yeah. And so it again, it goes back to a sort of values issue, but also a sort of information flow issue, in the sense that if people were more aware of the fact that, hey, you know, when you look at this from the meta crisis standpoint, like the long-term effects of this is going to impact your survival, is going to impact not just the well-being of your children and whatnot, but the quality of your life, even if you manage to survive. But you look at, you know, I mean, Ukraine, you look at Israel, and you see, like, I mean, these are massive, massive problems, right? They went from living what was normal lives to now something completely, you know, from a dystopian, right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's dystopic. So it can happen, and it can happen. And maybe there's just a lack of information, proper information flow, that would be persuasive for people to start to recalibrate that cost benefit analysis. It's like, okay, not only does this person have a shitty personality, but despite the short term benefits that they may offer me or my family or my group, whatever, long term, clearly this is not sustainable. And now, because I see that the long-term effects are in certain domains coming to fruition. For example, maybe you can look at climate change and you can see, okay, well, shit, like this has been, you know, like the hottest day ever, you know, and it's, you know, the past 100 days have been like the hottest the oceans have been, and you know, and so on and so forth. And it's just like, at some point, you know, something's got to give, and you're like, okay, like perhaps weight, more weight has to be put on the long term. And so maybe that's the kind of recalibration that could happen. But I don't know, just shooting some ideas.
I think I have a really good example that just happened, actually. I have a friend who a couple of days ago spent a night in prison. And what happened was that he had a few drinks, you know, with his staff party.
It happens.
Just a few drinks, was driving, taking a few of his staff back home. So he was driving them back home. And there was the police kind of like, you know, cordoned area to test the breathalyzer.
Okay.
Yeah, so he blew into it, you know, five times. Nothing came up. He blew it on the sixth time. I think it came out like, you know, 80 something when the kind of like the mark is at 50. So he's, you know, a little bit above it. Usually you'll get a warning, you know, a slap on the wrist and then you kind of like off you go. But no, the policeman wanted money. And then my friend was like, no way. I'm not doing it, you know? And he said he would rather to kind of like take him to the station, get him kind of like properly documented, and then he'll bail himself out with the money that he has. And then the police said, okay, go on then, we'll take you to the station. So my friend was taken over to the station. The police confiscated his phone. He couldn't call anyone. And then next thing he knew, he was put into jail overnight. Wasn't given any drinks, nothing. And then, you know, later on in the morning, the police, you know, came and unlocked the door, took him out, you know, drove him to eat, you know, started being really nice to my friend. Everyone else was like kind of like sitting in the back of the car. And then my friend actually sat in front with the policeman in the car driving back to, you know, into town. And he was like, you know, oh God, really impressed. He was like feeling like, my God, the policeman is actually really, really nice. What he later found was that his dad called up, you know, the police station, used up all his connections to get his son out. So that, you know, my friend could obviously get out. No problem. So he was actually getting special treatment from the police, you know, from the police station. And then he got told off by his dad in the end. And I thought that he was going to tell me that he got told off by his dad because he was, you know, drink driving. But no, he got told off for not paying the bribe. So we are seeing things like that happen, you know, all the time in our life, of people having different sets of values to us. And then them being, obviously, you know, the dad being the leader of the family unit, has a stronger voice, would say that, no, the right way is to pay the bribe. Because how could you be jeopardizing the family reputation?
I think...
And we're talking about like families of doctors here. You know, these are like doctors and professors in Thailand.
Well, surgeons are more likely to be sociopaths. So I don't know if he's a surgeon. But,
it is true.
I think at some level we have to reckon with the fact that there is just an advantage to not having integrity, to being sociopathic. It's just part of human nature, and I think it's an uphill battle for people who are interested in more just, fair, and sustainable societies. Like, it's just, it just is. And not everyone, you know, not everyone necessarily even cares for these values or wants them. Like, it's just, and I think you have to acknowledge, like, it's kind of a battle, because right now they're winning that battle and they don't give a shit, and they'll run the planet down. They'll destroy the planet for their benefit, or they'll have their bunkers. They'll be fine in according to what they think. But, I mean, I don't know about that.
But the problem is, you don't have integrity. But at what cost, though?
They don't see it that way, because they, you know, I think from an evolutionary standpoint, there is this programming of my survival is the most important thing. And my comfort, which signals is sort of a cue for survival, is also more important than anything else I can more or less think about in the distant future. So, yeah, I mean, it's just to optimize for those things provides you a fitness advantage over not doing so. Again, as far as, you know, the eye can see, but obviously but people that have more
misalignment. That's still a misalignment.
I agree. I'm with you. I think it is a misalignment, but
because like,
they don't see it that way.
Have you come across the Stanford study, the longest study that they've ever done on adult kind of like human happiness? Have you heard about that? The one that went on for like 86 years.
Maybe describe that to us.
So they kind of like followed people since like that they were like in their 20s, and then they're following like their grandkids, you know, their kind of great grandkids. And they basically did a study on, you know, what does it entails to for people to have in their lives to have happiness. And they distilled it in a way that it's not wealth, it's not health, it's not status, it's not power. What actually makes people happy is relationship. Mm-hmm. Like if you imagine like someone on their deathbed, right, saying like, oh my God, I regretted this, you know, I wish I did X, Y, Z, for example. And it's usually to do with a relationship. It's never about like, oh my God, I wish I have built, you know, 10 different companies. It's not about that. It's always going to be about another person, another relationship.
I think here's the problem with that. I mean, that's just another like thing that you add to the survival comfort issue, where happiness is great, but we're not optimized for happiness. We are optimized for the survival, right? And so sometimes the happiness is aligned with survival, but other times it's not. And I would say in our original, you know, evolutionary environment, it was much more aligned, where the things that did make you happy, these relationships were so critical to your survival, right? Like you had to have strong relationships, otherwise you're fucked when, you know, you're out of food. So once you scale up societies and you're not as dependent on people, then although you are unhappy because your relationships or lack of intimate relationships have suffered or decayed or whatever, because the other things that you do that society values for, you know, economic reasons still lends itself better to your survival and even status for reproduction, right? I mean, how much of you know, marriage and reproduction is based on status, right? It's a huge thing, and obviously, status is very much correlated with your economic value. Then these, like, we're going to continue to do the things that maximize the sort of survival and reproduction over the things that actually make us happy, because that's what we're designed to do. But people that are more enlightened would see like, oh shit, wait a minute. Like, this is like kind of like a biological trap, and I should be more cognizant of the things that make me happy, which is not to start another company, which is not to make another 20K this year. It's, oh, actually I would like more time to invest in my health, to invest in my friendships and my relationship and so on and so forth. So, I think that, that disconnect is something a lot of people probably don't recognize, because it's in your brain. It's just, you're spot on. It's just, yeah.
You're spot on. Yeah. Because if we're just looking from an evolutionary perspective, then yes, you know, survival and reproduction would be the primary objective, you know, for us. But 21st century is not, you know, it's actually the focus is health and happiness. We're not, you know, looking to reproduce any more than this. Because I think, you know, when we're talking about survival, we really were talking about survival from death. And then if you kind of like looking at like, you know, this kind of prism called like the Maslow hierarchy of needs, we're kind of like meeting the, you know, the physiological needs. You know, we were getting like kind of like the, you know, the food, you know, the air that we breathe. And then we're kind of meeting the safety needs, you know, like, you know, our house and everything. But the next one, this third one, the love and sense of belonging, that is where we are having issue. But we're jumping straight to the fourth one, which is self-esteem. But we're not meeting this, you know, the love and belonging stage. Hmm. And I think that actually can, you know, it kind of like captures the entire premise of what essentially is the problem with the mental disorder and the mental crisis with this kind of increase in personality disorder right now is we're not getting this sense of belonging and love fulfilled.
Hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. It's like all these things are interconnected. It's just, it's so crazy.
Yeah, I know.
Well, hey, this has been a really fascinating discussion. Of course, we really appreciate you coming on to discuss this. How can people reach you if they're interested in your work?
Oh, you can find me on Substack. I post interesting articles every week, you know, talking about this very thing that we covered today, you know, mostly about emotions, mostly about traumas, mostly about, you know, psychology and philosophy. But you can find me on Substack.
And that's awesome. Your first name, Chusana.
Chusana.substack.com. Yeah. I think it will be, you can find it on, the Soulful Systems. Soulful Systems.
Yeah. We'll put the link in our show notes. So
thank you.
Yeah. Thanks again. And I'm sure this is a discussion that needs to continue to be had.
We must. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Thank you.